Welcome all back to the second day of our conference. We are very, very happy today to have with us Xuheng Shao on Zoom from Stony Brook. And he's going to speak about non-invertible global symmetries, lo and behold, in the standard model. Thank you, Xuheng.
Thank you, Michele, for the very nice introduction. And hello, everyone. Good morning. Thank you for coming to my talk so early in the morning. And I'm sorry that I couldn't be there in person due to various personal green card issues. And I would really love to be there to talk to all of you guys. But in any case, I'll talk about non-invertible global symmetry in a standard model based on this very recent paper with my two excellent collaborators, my student Yicho Choi at Stony Brook and the postdoc Hota Lam, who is at MIT. Hota is actually there in person. So after the talk, if you have any questions, you know, please, I really encourage you to talk to Hota. He can explain all the details to you. And please also feel free to email me. I would really like to join the discussion in one way or another. I think there's a lot of interesting things going on, and I'm really curious to hear you guys' feedback. On the week of our paper, there was another closely related paper by Clay and Cantaro, and I also encourage you to read that interesting paper. And this talk will also be related to two of my other previous papers appear earlier this year. All right, so let's get started. So I'll start with something extremely basic that we learn in quantum field theory textbook. It's the 3+1 dimensional QED. I have a single flavor of massless unit charge Dirac fermion. All right, so this is the Lagrangian. Classically, as we all know, there's a U1 axial global symmetry that rotates the Dirac fermion with a famous gamma 5 matrix. I put a factor of 2 there, but it's just so that the alpha, the angle parameter, is such that it's 2 pi periodic. If you put alpha equals to 2 pi, this corresponds to the fermion parity, which is part of the gauge symmetry. Don't worry too much about the factors of 2, but it's the correct factor of 2. Now, famously, there's an Adler-Bell-Jakeev anomaly implying that the classical U1 axial symmetry fails to be a global symmetry quantum mechanically. The ABJ anomaly was discovered in the late 60s to explain the neutral pion decay. It successfully determined the coupling between the neutral pion and the photons in the chiral level. It was still the pre-QCD era. Now, conceptually, there is something very, very slightly counterintuitive. And really, I want to emphasize that the emphasis of this sentence is on the word slightly. So usually, we celebrate when we discover the existence of a global symmetry. ABJ anomaly is the statement that there isn't a global symmetry that one would have naively expected. So how come we could derive all this quantitative results from the absence of a global symmetry? Now, of course, the most standard explanation is that since the fine structure constant is so small in our real world, we can treat the electromagnetic gauge field as background. Then the pi zero FF term follows from the Wesolmino term, which captures all the Tu-Hoof anomalies in the chiral Lagrangian. And that was how Tu-Hoof made the argument. But wouldn't it be nice if we don't have to use the fact that the fine structure constant is small? Wouldn't it be nice that there is an honest to God certain generalized global symmetry in the QCD or in the chiral Lagrangian so that we can reinterpret this classic result from the existence of such generalized global symmetry rather than the absence thereof? I want to emphasize again, there's absolutely nothing wrong with the ordinary Tu-Hoof argument. It's just that here we want to provide an alternative understanding. So the goal of this talk is to show that the continuous invertible U1 axial global symmetry, which is there classically, is broken by the ABJ anomaly to a discrete non-invertible global symmetry, labeled by the rational numbers. In the pion Lagrangian, the coupling pi zero FF can be derived by matching the non-invertible global symmetry in the UBQCD. Therefore, to put it in a maximally offensive manner, one can say that the neutral pion decays because of the non-invertible global symmetry. All right. So now let me get into the details. So I'll start with a slide on the relation between symmetry and topology, which was really nicely summarized in Theo's opening remark and also in Justin's talk. But let me just repeat that quickly. Let's start with the quantum field theory with a conserved Noether current that obeying the conservation equation. I'll treat it as a one form, and therefore its conservation equation can be written as this way. From the current, we can take the time component and integrate it over the whole space and exponentiate it to get a U1 symmetry operator labeled by a rotation angle theta. For relativistic quantum field theory, which will be the main focus throughout this talk, the time direction is on the same footing as any other spatial direction. Therefore, we can choose to integrate the current on a general closed three manifold in our four-dimensional Euclidean space-time. In this way, we get a more general U theta of M, where this M is a three manifold embedded in our four-dimensional Euclidean space-time. When M is the whole space at a given time, this is an operator. When M extends in the time direction, this is a defect. Throughout the talk, I'll use the word operator and defect rather interchangeably. There's some important distinction, but I will not highlight them during this talk. And this is because in this talk, I will only focus on relativistic quantum field theory. But there's still an important difference, but that will not be too important for the purpose of this talk. For this operator, U theta, supported at a fixed time over the whole space, the conservation equation, this one, implies that it's independent of the Euclidean time evolution. Now that we consider this more general U theta of n, which can be an operator or defect, the conservation equation is upgraded to the fact that U theta of n depends on the choice of m only topologically. And this is a simple consequence of the divergence theorem. So the upshot is that whenever we have a symmetry, there is a corresponding U theta of m, a topological operator slash defect that you can insert into any correlation function. In QED, we do have a current, which we denote by J mu with a superscript A. It's given by this formula. It doesn't obey the conservation equation. It obeys an anomalous conservation equation. So its divergence is the wedge product of the dynamical field strength of the U1 electromagnetic gauge field, which I denote by capital F. Naively, we can still try to define the symmetry operator by integrating the axial current on a general three manifold M. However, because of this additional term on the right-hand side of the conservation equation, it is no longer topological. All right, so that's our first trial. It's not conserved. Let's try something different, as Adler did in his original paper in the late 60s. He defined a gauge non-invariant current, J hat, by shifting the original J, or more precisely the star J, by a transimus term, where the capital A is the dynamical U1 gauge field in a 3+1D bulk space-time. It is not gauge invariant because the transimus term is not gauge invariant. It is formally conserved because of the anomalous conservation equation. Formally, you can try to take this J hat, or star J hat more precisely, integrate it on any three manifold in space-time, and try to make an operator U hat. It is formally topological, but it's not gauge invariant because this integral of ADA, the level is not quantized. This is a transimus term on this three manifold M, but the coefficient depends on this alpha. So where are we now? Let's take a quick look at the scoreboard, which begin with this operator U. It is gauge invariant, but not topological. We then try this U hat, which is not gauge invariant, but is formally topological. So So it seems that there's no way that we can define a gauge invariant conserved quantity in QED. Let's try to be less ambitious. Let's choose the axial rotation angle to be a fraction, 2 pi over some positive integer n. Here, just introduce n out of nowhere. Then the gauge non-invariant piece of this u hat operator is this AD, this term I'm marking red. It is still not gauge invariant because the coefficient is not properly quantized. For a transignment's term, the level is properly quantized if it is an integer over 4 pi. But here is 1 over 4 pi n. It's a fractional transignment's term. Let's take a look at this term in red. This term actually has a very long history in condensed matter physics. So now we are taking a little detour and just look at this term and pretend that the m is our whole 2 plus 1 dimensional space time. And this term is in condensed matter physics is commonly used to describe the fractional quantum Hall effect in a 2 plus 1D system on m. It is, however, not gauge invariant, as we repeatedly emphasized. Fortunately, in condensed matter physics, there's a well-known fix to this issue. The more precise gauge invariant Lagrangian for the fractional quantum Hall effect is actually this Lagrangian, where we have introduced an additional dynamical U1 gauge field, the little a, that only lives on this 2 plus 1D manifold M. This Lagrangian is perfectly gauge invariant because every term is properly quantized. There's no fractional transignments term. What's the relation between the red Lagrangian and the blue Lagrangian? Naively, you can integrate out the little a in the blue Lagrangian, and you get this relation. You substitute this equality back in, you seem to retrieve the original red Lagrangian. This is, however, illegal, since both the little a and the capital A are properly quantized gauge fields with properly quantized fluxes on any two cycles, close two cycles. Therefore, we cannot divide any of this gauge field by a factor of n that will screw up the quantization condition. Of course, this is expected. On the left, you have a gauge non-invariant Lagrangian, and hence the quotation marks. On the right, you have a gauge invariant Lagrangian. To relate something illegal to something legal, you have to do something illegal. The upshot is that in the context of fractional quantum Hall effect, the Lagrangian on the right, the blue Lagrangian, is the precise gauge invariant description for the fractional quantum Hall effect. This is all in 2 plus 1. Now let's go back to QED in 3 plus 1. Motivated by this discussion in 2 plus 1, we're going to define a new operator, D, which I emphasize is different from u hat. That's the reason I use a different symbol. I'm going to define a new operator just by formally replacing this red piece by the blue piece here. Now we have an operator D, where this little a only lives on the three manifold M, where the operator D is supported on. Capital A, and let me remind you, is the bulk electromagnetic gauge field. Strictly speaking, when I write this definition of D, there should be a path integral over the little a on this three manifold M. Here and throughout, I'm just going to omit that path integral over little a in the definition of my new operator D. This is somewhat reminiscent of the eta prime sheet in Zohar's paper from a few years back. But anyway, now we have a new operator. Let's see what are its properties. The new operator is clearly gauge invariant because all the transignment terms are properly quantized. It is conserved, more generally topological. This is not immediately obvious. You can heuristically understand it by roughly equating these two, the blue piece and the red piece. But that's not a rigorous argument. Later on, I will prove it more rigorously by employing the magnetic one-form global symmetry of the QED. I'll say more about this later. The price we pay, however, so it seems like a nice story so far. We have a gauge invariant topological conserved quantity. But the price we pay is that it's not an invertible symmetry. But I should emphasize it's really a feature rather than a bug. And let's see why it fails to be invertible. So let me treat this as an operator. So my M is my spatial manifold. It could be some general three manifold, S2 times S1, or S3, or whatever. And I treat it as an operator acting on the ordinary Hilbert space of QED at a fixed time. As an operator, I can try to take the dagger. Well, that's easy. I just flip all the signs in the exponent, minus, minus, minus. But importantly, I have a little a for each of the operators. So I have an a for my original d, but now I have a bar, a different dynamical fields only living on the three manifold m for d dagger. I use different symbols to emphasize that they're really different. And you should really bear in mind that there's a path integral over a right here and a path integral over a bar right here. We now do the parallel fusion. We multiply d and d dagger together. In the Hamiltonian picture, that means we act the two of them on our Hilbert space sequentially. So what do we get? This piece cancel with each other, but we are left with something non-trivial. This is not a trivial operator. This is not the identity. It's also not a decouple operator, because it's coupled to the bulk electromagnetic gauge field A here. I'll call this operator C. And the only important thing you have to know at this point is that it's not the identity. Therefore, we see that D times D dagger is not one. So D is not a unitary operator. In fact, it's not invertible in particular. There's no inverse operator. This equality, this fusion rule, actually appears, similar fusion rules appears in Justin's talk yesterday. And let me just briefly make a comparison there. The C is what Justin introduced yesterday and is now called the condensation operator or defect these days. I can give another lecture on why it can be called a condensation operator. Indeed, in many of the examples, in almost all the examples I study, C can be realized as a Higgs mechanism that takes place only on the three manifold M. But here, let me just take it as an M. C can be realized from the higher gauging of a ZM magnetic one-form symmetry. Now, what is higher gauging? This is a term that we define in this recent paper from March. The higher gauging, or more precisely, the P gauging of a Q-form global symmetry, note that there are two positive integers or non-negative integers at play here. There's a P and there's a Q. The P gauging of a Q-form global symmetry is defined by gauging the Q-form symmetry only along a codimension P submanifold in space-time. So zero gauging of a Q-form symmetry corresponds to you gauge the higher form symmetry, the Q-form symmetry everywhere in space-time. And that maps from one quantum field theory to a different one. Higher gauging, however, does not change the bulk quantum field theory because all the action only takes place at the higher codimension manifold. Rather, it generates a codimension P topological defect in the same bulk quantum field theory. And this was called a condensation defect in the condensed matter literature here, and also in this very nice paper by Davide and Seal. The C here, which pops out from the fusion between D and D dagger in QED, is exactly of this kind. It arises from the one gauging of a ZM magnetic one-form symmetry along this three manifold M. It's called one gauging because we are gauging the ZM magnetic one-form symmetry only along a codimension one manifold M. So the structure we see here is that there's a non-invertible defect D. When it fuses with itself, you get a condensation defect C. And the condensation defect C itself is also a non-invertible defect. This is a similar fusion rule as the one Justin discussed yesterday. So previously we were talking about D1 over N operator that's associated with a chiral rotation of 2 pi over N. It's easy to generalize this to arbitrary rational axial angle, 2 pi p over N, with GCD p comma N equals to 1. All you have to do is to replace the U1 trans-Simons part by what is called the minimal ZNT QFT. Of course, here you can actually put any 2 plus 1 D TQFT with a ZN1 point symmetry with the appropriate anomaly labeled by P. But any such TQFT can be decomposed into a minimal TQFT plus something else. That was shown in this paper by Hota, Poshen, and Naki. And therefore, the resulting operator will be a decoupled product between this DP over N and the decoupled 2 plus 1 DTQFT. In that sense, this is the minimal one. There's a side comment that there's some slightly more general construction, which doesn't factorize into this guy times something else, but I'll not say too much about it. It's in our appendix. So the upshot at this point is that the continuous invertible U1 axial symmetry in QED is broken by the ABJ anomaly to a discrete non-invertible global symmetry, labeled by the rational numbers P over N. This phenomenon that invertible symmetry suffering from an ABJ anomaly turns to a non-invertible global symmetry under gauging is a generalization of the construction in this very beautiful paper from last year. In this paper from last year, they mostly focus on the discrete ABJ anomaly and how that turns into a non-invertible global symmetries. The slight novelty here we have is that we start with a continuous ABJ anomaly. And the resulting non-invertible global symmetry is even weirder. It's labeled by the rational numbers. The rational numbers are dense in U1, so it's almost like a continuous symmetry, but not quite. So now we have our scoreboard. We have the first operator we talk about, it's gauge invariant, it's not topological, and therefore its invertibility is a little bit ambiguous. So that's why I put NA here. Then we have a U hat operator that's not gauge invariant, it is topological, and it's formally invertible. Finally, we have this non-invertible operator. I only write the case for D1 over N, but in the previous slide, we also have the more general DP over N. They're labeled by the rational number. They are gauge invariant, they are topological, but it's not invertible. All right, any question at this point?
Hi, Shuheng. I have a brief question. Did I understand correctly that you can get this non-invertible symmetry by, if you formally say that the dynamical gauge field A is quantized to 2 pi n, fluxes, then the operator, second operator there would be a good gauge invariant operator. Is that correct?
That would be a different theory, though.
It would be a different theory. But then, did I understand correctly that when you gauge a one-form symmetry of that theory, you get your operator? Or did I misunderstand something?
Well, first, it would be a different theory. So my operator only exists in the theory of unit charge QED. In the different theory, there will be some other operators. You can ask, of course, if I gauge the ZN one-form symmetry to go from one to another, is there a relation between these two sets of operators in two different theories? I haven't thought about that, but I believe the answer is yes. I think that's probably the case. And that's, again, similar to the comment I made here, because there might be some relation, because that ZN symmetry, that ZN zero point symmetry in your theory will suffer from some ABJ anomaly with the gauge symmetry. But I haven't really thought about that, but it's quite likely that's the case.
And I have a second question. Is there a notion, could you imagine the theory being the form in some way to break this non-invertible symmetry completely? And is there a notion of relevance or irrelevance of such breaking?
The question to the first part of the answer is certainly yes. It's very easy to break this symmetry. I will say a little bit about it. And in Clay and Cantaro's paper, they say more about it. And there are more than one ways to break it. As I will mention later on, the construction of this symmetry relies on the magnetic one-point symmetry. So the moment you have a dynamical monopole, this symmetry will be broken. And that was discussed in detail by Clay and Cantaro. But since this operator is codimension one, you can also explicitly break it by adding some terms in the Lagrangian, such as the mass term for the QED.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks.
So if I understand, like you're telling us, we have this operator which has itself supports, I guess you said it here, itself, like this 3D operator supports a TFT living on it, yes? And that is another way of just directly seeing it's not invertible, because it has non-trivial operators on itself.
Yes.
Okay.
But it's not a decoupled TFT. It's coupled to the bulk magnetic gauge field A here. Of course, one can always take an invertible symmetry, stack a decoupled 3DT QFT on it, and make it non-invertible. But that's always a little bit boring, because you can just factor that out. Here, the novelty is that if you remove this part, this piece alone is not a topological symmetry operator because of the anomalous conservation equation. Then you can fix it by coupling to a 3D TQFT and to make it topological. But the price you pay is that it's no longer invertible for exactly the reason you just said. All right. Any other question?
I was wondering what is the action of this non-invertible symmetry on operators? For example, I'm at least naively, I would say that on local operator, its action is the same as axial rotation by angle alpha equal 1 over n. Is it correct?
It is correct, and I will have much more to say about that in the few slides.
And so, for example, the non-invertibility can be tracked only by the action on extended operator.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's absolutely correct. And I'll have much more to say about it.
Okay, thank you.
Just a few moments.
Yeah. I have a question. Hi, Shuhei.
Yes. Hi.
This is Nati.
Yeah. I figured that out.
Who else asked so many questions? You made the analogy with the eta prime a number of times in the introduction. But if I understand you...
Not a number of times, only once. Only once.
I think you mentioned it twice, once with Komagotsky and the other with the Wezum.
All right.
In any event, if I understand what you're saying here, it's really unlike the eta prime.
You are absolutely right.
Okay,
You are absolutely right. I used the word reminiscent because this piece appears in Zohar's paper. But the physics is fundamentally different.
No, it's also not reminiscent because the starting point of what you're doing is the magnetic symmetry.
Yes, and absolutely.
This is the leftover of the magnetic 100%, 100%, symmetry. And in the other case, there's no magnetic symmetry.
Okay, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. I might even have a slide about it later on.
Shuhei, it's Dan. When you say that the symmetry is topological, what exactly do you mean? For example, do you allow the three manifold to undergo a surgery through a Bordism or just an isotopy?
That's a very nice question. The short answer is I don't really know. I think it depends more than just on the homological class. I think it might depend more on just the homological class of the three manifold M. While I roughly have in mind is that you have some Euclidean correlation function, you insert this M and you make some little smooth deformation, then the correlation function remains the same. But exactly, you know, whether it's the isotopic class or homotopic class, I'm not exactly sure. So I don't want to make a commitment to the statement.
Okay, thanks.
I have one question.
That's a very nice question. Yeah. Oh, sorry, let me just make one last comment. So to really fully answer, Dan, your question, I think one needs to study the crossing relation between all these defects, which we haven't done so yet. But in 1 plus 1D, topological lines in 1 plus 1D, that's completely well known. For topological lines in 2 plus 1D, that's also known. But I don't think anyone has done the similar analysis in 3 plus 1. So I don't really know the full precise mathematical statement. Sorry, there was another question?
My question was, since these are labeled by rational numbers, it's almost continuous. Are there goldstones when this is spontaneously broken? Is there a way to think about this?
That's an excellent question. And I also don't want to make a commitment, but I will organize the talk in such a way to trick you to think that there should be a goldstone boson. And I'm very tempted to say that the pi zero is a goldstone boson, but I don't want to make that assertion so bluntly. I'm very intrigued by this question, but let me not give you a yes or no answer. Okay. There's no more questions. And thank you for all the questions. And these are really very nice questions. No? Okay, so we have a non-invertible global symmetry. Why should we call them generalized global symmetries? Well, they're non-invertible topological operator. Why do they qualify as symmetry? We should think about symmetries as a very sacred word that we can label the operator by. Justin gave very beautiful review on the development of non-invertible symmetry. So that will save me a lot of time. But let me just quickly go through some arguments for advertising, for thinking about all these non-invertible topological operators as symmetries. And this was based on various developments in the past years. So first of all, some of these non-invertible symmetries can be gauged. Just like an ordinary symmetry, there's a generalized gauging procedure. When there's an obstruction to gauging, there's a generalized anomalies, which leads to generalized two-hoop anomaly matching condition, which in turn results in non-trivial constraints on the renormalization group flows. This has been discussed in various papers here. Third, in quantum gravity, it's commonly believed that there's no global symmetry. And recently, the no global symmetry conjecture is argued to be generalized to the absence of invertible and non-invertible global symmetries. And finally, that's basically stated in the title of this Simons collaboration. And I feel like this is the one occasion where I don't really need to further justify why we should code these non-invertible operators as symmetries. In the past year, as beautifully summarized by Justin, there has been a lot of developments on constructing non-invertible symmetry, especially co-dimension one non-invertible symmetries. So you can call them non-invertible zero-form symmetry if you wish, in familiar 3 plus 1 dimensional lattice and continuum gauge theories. Here I made a list of relevant papers. There might be more. Some of these constructions apply to quantum field theories that are invariant under gauging a discrete one-form symmetry, G. So generally, you can start with the quantum field theory with a one-form symmetry G and only gauge this discrete one-form symmetry G on half of the space-time and impose a topological Dirichlet boundary condition. This generally gives you a topological interface between one quantum field theory and another. When it so happens that the quantum field theory is isomorphic to its gauge version, and I can give another lecture on what we meant by isomorphism. You can see more details in this paper. But when there's an isomorphism between the two, then this interface becomes a defect in the single quantum field theory. And this is how a lot of such non-invertible defects were constructed in these papers. And that's also the case for our non-invertible defect D in QED. So from this point on, I will assume there's no monopole at the energy scale in QED that we are interested in. Then, in the absence of dynamical monopole, QED has a magnetic U11 form symmetry, whose current is a 2-form, which is a star F. And its conservation just follows from the Bianchi identity of the field strength F. We can choose a ZN1-form subgroup of this U1 magnetic 1-form symmetry engage this ZN one-point symmetry with a specific choice of the discrete torsion class that depends on an integer p. I'll not say too much about this discrete torsion, but you can find it in our paper. After three or four lines of algebra, you can show that gauging the ZN one-point symmetry with that discrete torsion class, note that the N enters into the ZN subgroup, the P enters into the discrete torsion class. The net effect of this discrete gauging is to shift the QED theta angle by P over N, 2 pi P over N. Of course, in QED, we know that the theta in massless QED, the theta angle is not meaningful. More precisely, we can undo this shift by performing an axial rotation on the Fermi. We can therefore construct the non-invertible defect dp over n by composing this discrete gauging and this change of variable axial rotation in half of the spacetime and impose a Dirichlet boundary condition on the interface. And since the composition of these two operations returns the original QED, this gives you a defect in the original QED. Since the Dirichlet boundary condition is topological, this proves rigorously why our D is topological. As was already anticipated by questions from the audience, we can now determine how the defect, how the operator D acts on various operators. And this can be determined by the gauging construction. Since the construction of D involves gauging a one-point symmetry and the axial rotations, it acts on the fermions as an axial rotations, and it's an invertible action on the fermions. What's non-invertible comes about from the point where we gauge the one-point symmetry, and it therefore acts non-invertibly on the two hoop lines. Since the theta angle is shifted by this amount, you can see that the two hoop line will undergo a weakening effect and acquires a fractional electric charge. What that means in Euclidean space-time is that as you sweep this topological operator D past a genuine two-hoop line H, it becomes a surface operator ending on the original line H. And this surface is an integral of F with a fractional coefficient. The fact that the two-hoop line, which is a genuine line operator, is now mapped to a line attached to a surface is the hallmark that this is a non-invertible symmetry. Let's explore some consequences of the non-invertible symmetry in QED. And I'll start with Tuhoof's notion of naturalness. Tuhoof said a theory is natural if in the following sense. If the theory has a global symmetry G, you can impose the global symmetry G. And then you should include all the G invariant terms with coefficients of order one without fine tuning in the Lagrange. Let's apply Tuhoof's notion of naturalness to QED, to the massless QED. This is the massless QED, but then you can ask what stops us from adding the mass term to this massless QED Lagrange. If you have not known the non-invertible global symmetry, there doesn't seem to be any principle forbidding you from turning on a mass term for the Dirac fermion. But now we can say that the electron mass term, well, the electron mass term violates the non-invertible global symmetry because the non-invertible global symmetry acts on the fermion fields just as an axial rotation. So now we can say that the electron is naturally massless in the Tuhoof sense in QED because of the non-invertible global symmetry. And I encourage you to read more about discussions on naturalness in Clay and Cantaro's paper. Well, that's a fancy way of saying something we all know. And it's curious to see how Tuhoof thought about it in the 80s. So let's take a look. This is a paragraph from Tuhoof's papers in the 80s. There's a section called naturalness in QED. So how did he say it? He said that QED is a natural theory. In particular, the mass, ME, are very small. And the relevant symmetry here for his notion of naturalness is the chiral symmetry, it's the axial symmetry. But of course, Tuhuf knew the ABJ anomaly, so he added a sentence saying that we need not be concerned about the ABJ anomaly here, because the photon field being abelian and there's no instanton in flat space. Which is true, but now we offer an alternative interpretation on the naturalness in QED, in massless QED. We can say a little bit more. We have a few more postdictions about QED. The operator, as we said, acts invertibly on fermions as axial rotation. And the selection rules on the fermions on flat space amplitudes are the same as the naive U1 axial symmetry. And as Tuhuf commented in his paper, there's no U1 instanton in flat space because pi 3 of U1 is zero. So that means all these flat space amplitudes should still obey the naive U1 axial symmetry selection rule, which now you can understand as the selection rules from the non-invertible symmetry. This implies that the total helicity of the electrons in the positron has to be conserved in massless QED. Note that the photon helicity doesn't have to be conserved in QED. So for example, if you look at the electron-positron annihilation amplitudes, the amplitude is only non-zero if the helicities for the electron and the positrons are opposite. This helicity conservation is usually explained using gamma matrices in quantum field theory textbook. For example, this is from Paskin and Schroeder, chapter 5. They did some gamma 5 exercise and conclude that the amplitudes vanish in the massless limit unless the electron and positron have opposite helicity. They didn't explain this using the axial global symmetry because they knew very well down the road this symmetry will have an anomaly. Of course, you can say that because there's no instanton in flat space for U1, the selection rules still holds, but that would be too advanced an explanation in chapter 5 of the textbook. Here we offer probably even more advanced understanding of the selection rule using the non-invertible global symmetry. All right, so that's so much for QED. Now let's move on to QCD. And I will only work below the electroweak scale, where the SU2 times U1 gauge symmetry is already broken to the U1 electromagnetic gauge symmetry. Below the electroweak scale, and I will also work in the massless quark mass limit. So in the massless limit of QCD below the electroweak scale, the QCD Lagrangian for the up and down quarks has an axial global symmetry. So I call it U1A3, which acts on up and down quarks by this. There's a gamma 5, that's why it's axial. There's a sigma 3, and that's why I put a subscript 3 here. It means that it rotates U and D oppositely. This is the symmetry that will eventually correspond to the neutral pi on pi zero. This global symmetry suffers from an ABJ anomaly with the electromagnetic U1 gauge symmetry. So this is the triangle diagram responsible for the ABJ anomaly. Related to Nati's comment, this is not to be confused with the other axial symmetry without the sigma 3. So classically, there's another axial symmetry that rotates U and D in the same way. That symmetry suffers from SU3 ABJ anomaly. And we have nothing smart to say about that ABJ anomaly. Now, focusing on this one, U1A3, by the exact same construction, we conclude that there's an infinite non-invertible global symmetry D in the UVQCD from U1A3. Maybe I should put a quotation mark on UV here because I really work below the electroweak scale, but above the pion scale. Now we can ask, how does the IR pion Lagrangian capture this infinite non-invertible global symmetry D? The relevant terms in the pion Lagrangians that will be useful for us are these two. The pion field is a compact scalar field with periodicity 2 pi f pi. F pi is the pion decay constant. And here I include a coupling between pi zero and f wedge f with a coupling g. For all we know, g can be zero at this point, and we will try to determine it later on. The non-invertible global symmetry D shift the pion field in the following way. This is also how the U1A3 would have acted on pi 0. In the next slide, I will argue that the equations of motion in the presence of the non-invertible global symmetry D will fix the coefficient G in the pion Lagrangian to be non-zero, to be a very specific constant. And that gives the dominant contribution to the neutral pion decay. So how does this calculation proceed? You take the bulk Lagrangian, the pion Lagrangian, and you insert a defect of D at x equals to 0. So now I'm not treating it as an operator, but I'm treating it as a defect inserted at x equals to 0, extending all time in y and z. So I have a defect at x equals to 0. I have a bulk pion Lagrangian on one side and a bulk pion Lagrangian on the other side. And then I just go on and write down the equation of motion for the pion field, for the bulk electromagnetic gauge field, the big A, and for this little a that only lives on the defect. I got three equations. With a little bit of algebra, you conclude that these three equations are only compatible with each other if the coupling G is fixed to be this particular value. Conventionally, the pion decay is explained by the ABJ anomaly. And of course, since the fine structure constant is so small, we can treat the electromagnetic gauge field as background, and then pi zero FF follows from the Tuhuv anomaly matching condition. Here we provided an alternative explanation for the pion decay as a direct consequence from matching the non-invertible global symmetry in the UVQCD. And the emphasis is on the word global. The non-invertible global symmetry gives the invariant characterization of the ABJ anomaly in this particular case. I'm not making any general claim for the more general ABJ anomaly, but just for the U1 abelian ABJ anomaly, in terms of the existence of a generalized global symmetry rather than the absence thereof. Even though the non-invertible symmetry is discrete, it's labeled by the rational numbers. And as Yibu was asking previously, it's dancing U1, so it's almost a continuous symmetry. We usually say that the pi zero is the Goldstone boson of an anomalous U1 axial symmetry, which is a statement I'm always a little bit confused by. What does it mean to have a Goldstone boson of an anomalous symmetry? If the symmetry isn't there, what is this Goldstone boson? The pi zero, it is so light, so it does behave like a Goldstone boson, but at the same time, it has a non-derivative coupling with the photon fields, which makes it not really a conventional Goldstone boson. The conventional argument is that, oh, the fine structure constant is so small, so let's first turn it off, and then pi zero is an honest to God Goldstone boson, and then we can continuously turn on the fine structure constant, and most of the nice properties of the pi zero should still remain there. But perhaps, and only perhaps, we can view the pi zero as the Goldstone boson for the non-invertible symmetry. I kind of hesitated to say those words because the non-invertible symmetry is discrete, it's labeled by the rational numbers. But on the other hand, the rational numbers are so dense in U1, so maybe it does make sense to say that the Goldstone boson is that the pi zero is a Goldstone boson for this infinite discrete non-invertible symmetry. Well, one piece of evidence is that the non-invertible symmetry shifts the pion fields. So the pi zero field realizes the non-invertible symmetry non-linearly. In that sense, it does behave like a Goldstone boson. All right, so previously we talked about the fusion between D and D dagger. What about D and D? It's generally quite complicated, but when N is odd, you can work it out. And it takes this form, where the coefficient, so naively you fuse D1 over N with D1 over N, you get D2 over N, but you actually get a non-trivial coefficient here. And let me remind you, An, 2 is the minimal TQFT, the minimal Zn TQFT with two units of anomaly. The point is that the fusion coefficient here is not a number, but it's a full-fledged 2 plus 1 DTQFT. you fuse two operators or defects supported on the manifold M. You parallel fuse them together, and you can replace this configuration by the right-hand side, where you have a D2 over N and a decoupled QFT A. More generally, I will argue that the fusion coefficient of D-dimensional topological defects should be a D-dimensional TQFT. And we provided several such examples in these two papers. So the slogan is that the fusion algebra between topological defects in quantum field theory is really a fusion algebra over TQFT coefficients. Usually when mathematicians talk about algebra, we say algebra over complex coefficients, over Z2, et cetera. But I would really argue that topological defects in quantum field theory furnish a fusion algebra over TQFT coefficient. I don't understand what that means mathematically, but as a very low-brow physicist, what I meant is that I can take two topological defects, I fuse them, I get another topological defect. There might be more terms generally, but in all the examples we study, it takes this form. And the coefficient here is the TQFT. It's the partition function of the TQFT T on M. This might sound totally bizarre or exotic, but let me give you one familiar example that should be familiar to most of the audience. That's the case when the topological defects are lines in space-time. There, so let me denote the line defect by LA. The fusion coefficient take this familiar form where the coefficients are non-negative integers n. Mathematically, this fusion is called a Z plus ring. There are some other conditions that you can find in the tensor category textbooks by Adinkoff and collaborators. This is a little screenshot from their textbook, the definition of Z plus ring. And what is a Z plus ring? It's some fusion ring where the coefficients are non-negative integers, and there are some assumptions on the unit element and the preferred choice of the basis. Physically, what does this coefficient n mean? These non-negative integers should be viewed as a 0 plus 1 dtqft. What is a 0 plus 1 dtqft? It's a topological quantum mechanics. What is a topological quantum mechanics? It's a quantum mechanics with trivial Hamiltonian. And what is a quantum mechanics with a trivial Hamiltonian? It's just a free n-dimensional qubit. So the Hilbert space is n-dimensional, and you have a trivial Hamiltonian. That's it. There's no excited state. So the n here should really be thought of as the Hilbert space of an n-dimensional 0 plus 1D topological quantum mechanics. And for higher dimensional topological defects, we expect that we should replace this 0 plus 1D TQFT by a general higher dimensional TQFT. So in that sense, you can say that the TQFTs are categorical generalizations of non-negative integers. Although I have absolutely no idea what that means mathematically. And I hope our mathematician friends in the audience can give us more insight in what this can possibly mean. All right, I will conclude my talk. So in this talk, I talk about massless QED and QCD, and I argue that the continuous invertible U1 axial symmetry is not completely broken by the ABJ anomaly. The ABJ anomaly turns it into a discrete non-invertible symmetry D labeled by the rational numbers. Here I copy the expression for the case of 1 over n again, which intuitively can be thought of as a composition of the naive axial rotation with a fractional quantum Hall state. To put this in the maximally offensive manners, one can say that the neutral pion decays because of the non-invertible global symmetry. The fusion algebra between the non-invertible defects in a general quantum field theory is a fusion algebra over TQFT coefficients. And I'm really curious to understand what that means mathematically. I talked to a couple of fusion two category mathematicians, but based on what I was told, it's not quite a fusion N category, but I'm not an expert in fusion N category, so I would love to understand more. If you take the pi on Lagrangian, it takes the identical form as an axiom Maxwell theory. So by exactly the same construction, one reaches the conclusion that the axiom Maxwell theory also has infinitely many non-invertible global symmetry. And in that sense, you might say that the axiom is a Goldstone boson for the anomalous for the non-invertible global symmetry. And for more discussion, please see Clay and Cantaro's paper. Finally, I will end my slide with a little timetable I made, which is highly inaccurate for the development of non-invertible global symmetry. Mostly I focus on codimension one non-invertible global symmetry in this timetable. It goes back to the 60s, where there are a lot of discussions on the Young-Baxter equation, infinitely many conserved charges in 1 plus 1D integrable systems. It was not phrased as non-invertible symmetry for sure, but it was there already. And then in the 80s, there were a lot of developments on 1 plus 1D RCFT and the related 2 plus 1D TQFT, and the mathematical framework of non-invertible symmetry or non-invertible lines were already developed there. And then for a long time, most of the discussion were in 1 plus 1. About a few years ago, people have reinterpreted these non-invertible lines in 1 plus 1D as generalized global symmetry and derived non-trivial constraints on RG flows in 1 plus 1D. And whenever I gave talks during that period, people always ask me, are there higher dimension, are there codimension one non-invertible topological defects in higher space-time dimensions? And I didn't quite know the answer. And then there were a lot of developments in just the past year. And now we are here finding that some of the well-known statements in QED and QCD can be phrased in terms of non-invertible global symmetries. I'm sure there will be more to come in the future, and I will end my talk here. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the very nice talk. Are there further questions from the audience? There is a question there.
Hey. Can we go back to the conclusion slide?
Yes.
Yeah, here we, if we decorate on M abelian fractional quantum Hall state, we can interpret the axial anomaly in terms of this way. But if I replace it by some non-abelian fractional quantum Hall state, do you think it's possible to view the SU3 QCD type axial anomaly?
Thank you very much for that question. The short answer, I think, is no. From this way of thinking about it, so you see, I presented my talk in the following way. In the beginning of the talk, I presented in a heuristic manner. I started with a gauge non-invariant fractional quantum Hall Lagrangian, and I just replace it by something else and say that this seems like something natural to do. But that's not a rigorous derivation. The rigorous derivation is based on the magnetic one-form symmetry, which Nati already, probably envisioned this question. So we should really follow the symmetry to see when our construction works or not. So to give a really no-go argument on any possible generalization of this to the case of ABJ anomaly involving SUN gauge theory, we should follow the global symmetry. And that's in my backup slide. So for the abelian case, which I discuss in the bulk part of the talk, you can ask, what is the abstract characterization of our non-invertible symmetry? The abstract way to characterize it is that take any quantum field theory with a U1 one-form symmetry with a conserved current J2, it's an issue. The abstract quantum field theory should obey these two conditions. First, it should have a U1 one-form symmetry. Second, it has a one-form current obeying the anomalous conservation equation. Whenever you have these two operator equations, you can go ahead and construct our non-invertible symmetry in this using this general expression. if you replace the gauge group by SUN, then there's no magnetic symmetry. And therefore, I cannot play this game anymore. And that would be my no-go argument for the absence of this non-invertible symmetry in the case of SUN gauge symmetry. Indeed, there's no way we can think about eta prime as a Goldstone boson for finite n. For finite n, we know that eta prime is quite heavy. So I think that's another hint that there's no such non-invertible global symmetry. If you replace the gauge group by PSUN, then there will be a magnetic gauge symmetry, a magnetic global one-form symmetry. It will be discrete. And indeed, there will be non-invertible topological defects coming from gauging that discrete magnetic one-form symmetry in PSUN gauge theory. And that was discussed in Clay and Kantaro's paper.
I see. Thank you. Can I ask one more question?
Yes, please.
In your proposed interpretation of a panel as the Goldstone of these non-invertible symmetries, should I think of these non-invertible symmetries as being spontaneously broken?
Again, I hesitated to make any such statement because the word Goldstone was reserved for continuous symmetry. But I'm very tempted to say the answer is yes. And that's why I added this bullet point to highlight the fact that the non-invertible symmetry is realized non-linearly on the pion field. Mm-hmm. So maybe in that regard, you can say that the non-invertible symmetry is spontaneously broken by the pion field.
Thank you.
Yeah. If I understood your argument, for the defect is to say that when you quotient or gauge by a subgroup of the U1 magnetic symmetry, that that you get a theory isomorphic to the original. Is that right?
Yes.
And why is that? And what is that isomorphic?
Right. I didn't show the detailed calculation. It's in the paper. It's a maybe two lines of algebra.
I see.
But that was what I was trying to summarize here. It's a straightforward calculation. So you introduce the Zn, the discrete two-form gauge field for the Zn one-form subgroup of the magnetic one-form symmetry. You add the discrete torsion class. You can think about it as an action for that discrete gauge field. And then you can start integrating out this discrete gauge fields. You do some gauge fixing, you integrate those out. After two lines of algebra, you will see that the net effect is to shift the theta angle by this amount. But since the theta angle is not physical in massless QED, you can undo that by a change of variables.
I see.
And you can even track the way the QED is coupled to the U1 magnetic one-form background. Sorry, the U1 two-form background gauge field for the magnetic one-form symmetry. And even the coupling is not changed. And that's what I meant by the isomorphism. Before and after gauging, the partition function of QED coupled to the U1 magnetic one-form global symmetry background gauge fields are exactly the same. And the isomorphism allows for adding gravitational counterturns that are independent of the background gauge field for the magnetic one-form symmetry.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
Shuheng, there is a question on the chat.
Okay.
Do you want to read it? Do you want me to read it?
I can read it, yeah. So okay. The question is, in the QCD case, the U1A3 is embedded in SU2A. Well, first, let me already comment there. I don't think there's a SU2A. Right? The axial symmetry doesn't form a group. If you take the commutator between two generator of the axial symmetry, you get a vector one. So it's not precise to call it SU2A. But the U1A3 is a group, but there's no axial SU2. But let me continue. The U1A3 is embedded in SU2A. So I'm wondering what is the fate of the other symmetry current in SU2A and how they will fit the non-invertible symmetry coming from the diagonal U1A. Thanks. Right. So yes, I think there's a bigger algebra which we didn't explore. So the short answer is, I don't know. In fact, let me just say that we didn't even close the algebra of DP over N. we didn't determine the full fusion rule between dp1 over n1 and dp2 over n2. And it could be a very complicated algebra. So before I even talk about other symmetry elements, I should first try to close the algebra, which we haven't done so. It's kind of interesting that we don't even know what's the full symmetry algebra in Mass's QED. And I think that's a very concrete and interesting question to pursue.
I had a quick question. You mentioned right at the beginning that this axial symmetry mixes with fermion parity, right? So is that also true of this new non-invertible symmetry, that you have some sort of fusion higher category mixed with fermion parity somehow?
Fermion parity, however, is not a symmetry. It's not a global symmetry. It's part of the gauge symmetry. That's what I meant to say here. Namely, if I take alpha to be 2 pi, this corresponds to fermion parity, and that's a trivial action on all gauge invariant configurations. What I can comment is that, for example, if you take a multiple flavor or maybe non-unit charge, let's say multiple flavors, then there will be a ZNF chiral symmetry that's non-anomalous and it's invertible. And that will be embedded into this more general non-invertible category.
Yeah, I have a question. Your construction relies on this trick of adding this gauge field on the three manifold. Because you started from this topological but not gauge invariant operator, which is not gauge invariant because of large gauge transformation. No? So there should be also, let's say, an easier way to construct a gauge invariant operator, which is just summing over the orbit of the gauge transformation. So do you think this produces just a trivial operator, or maybe it's just an equivalent description of your operator?
I'm not sure. I don't know if summing over gauge non-invariant configuration will give you a consistent defect. I haven't thought about it, but it's not obvious to me that will work.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Regarding this question, this is Nati again. The argument based on weak coupling, which I do remember from my youth, I think the modern way of saying it is that we can just make believe that the gauge group is R rather than U1, and then this defect, this new current, does lead to a conserved charge.
I agree, but I would like to work with compact gauge groups in compact spacetime.
Yeah, I also like that. But in order to derive properties of pions in R4 with QED, then that argument is still valid.
I'm always a little bit confused. Maybe you can explain to me. Why is it okay to change the global structure of a gauge group in one step of the argument?
No, from the beginning, just make believe that the gauge group of QED is R.
Uh-huh.
Work on R4, and then we derive properties of pions. I don't think you'll make any mistake.
But then it's a question about whether the gauge group, what do we mean by make believe?
Consider a theory where the gauge group is R. It's exactly the same.
Then I have no problem. Yes. Yeah, if the starting point is that the gauge group is R, then I have absolutely no problem. But don't we believe that things in our real world, there are gravity, and don't we believe that our gauge group should be compact?
Well, that argument is circular, because we also believe that in the real world, there are no non-invertible symmetries.
Fair enough.
And this is common in physics. There's a problem that we are interested in. We throw away whatever is not interesting. Mm-hmm. And then the problem has new features because we threw away some stuff, and which allows us to solve it.
Well, as I kept emphasizing, I have zero problem with the ordinary argument. But here I'm just providing an alternative argument in the case when the gauge group is compact and the space-time is also compact. And I completely agree with you. If we start with assuming that the gauge group is R, or if we work with non-compact space-time with no two-hoop line insertion, then you know the usual thing just carry over. In fact, in Adler's paper, in Adler's 69 paper, he considers this operator. Let me see, where is it? Yeah, in Adler's 69 paper, he considered this operator integrated over R3. And he said explicitly, this is a gauge invariant operator, which is true on R3. So I have absolutely zero problem when in the case when either the gauge group is R or the space-time is non-compact.
Hey, I think we don't have more time for further questions. There is coffee waiting outside. We can thank the speaker again for the very inspiring talk.
Thank you very much. And